This is Sharon Christofiak, guest host today, and Paul Weber is on the call with us, but he offered me the opportunity to introduce Dr. Catherine Murphy, and I was absolutely thrilled and jumped at the chance. For those that aren't familiar with Dr. Murphy, better known to her friends as Cath, she has a very illustrious career, and we are just so pleased to have her on the teleclass today. She's been a guest researcher with the CDC in healthcare quality and infection prevention. She's worked in Southeast Asia with the World Health Organization during the SARS outbreak. She's managed the New South Wales State Government Healthcare-Associated Infection and Control Program. She's been honored by the Australian Infection Control Association, member of the editorial boards for Australian and American Journal of Infection Control, AJIC. And she's also president-elect of our APIC organization and will be president next year. So I could go on for hours and hours talking about Cath, and I think you'd probably rather hear her talk herself. We'd like to introduce Dr. Catherine Murphy. Cath?
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to take part, this morning it is for me, or tomorrow morning, in your time. So to Paul Weber, thank you for this opportunity, and for those of you that have joined in, then I welcome the opportunity, even though I don't have that direct interaction with you at the moment, and Sharon, for your kind words. So it's actually a really passionate topic that I'm able to speak about today, and one of the good things, very good things about this opportunity was that I was able to choose and select both the topic and the things that I wanted to speak around generally in the presentation today. So that was a really nice thing, rather than being asked on a specific topic. And something that's very dear and close to my heart, and always has been through my infection prevention career, has been better understanding the roles of professional associations and how they contribute to improving our profession. And for me, I think they're absolutely a fundamental part of our professional growth. So I'll spend all of the time this morning talking about the associations, but just for a few seconds back to me, and I'd like to move on to the second slide with you, which is my disclaimer and conflict of interest, and just draw your attention primarily to the fact that from time to time, I am a casual consultant to multiple medical device manufacturers, to governments, and to some professional associations. Currently, in my role as APIC president-elect, I'm involved extensively with APIC, but none of the material that I present this morning is in any way associated with those other activities or positions. So I just need for you to understand that. So we'll move on to the third slide. And another important point is that I'd like to acknowledge some of my dear colleagues who helped me and gave me permission for the use of a few of their slides. That's Cathy Warrow, the Chief Executive of APIC, and Denise Murphy, who's currently the Vice President of Quality at Mainline Health System in Philadelphia. So I'm grateful for their help as well. We'll move on to the next slide and look at the objectives. There are so many professional associations that exist in the world that it was difficult for me to narrow my scope, but I thought I'd really like to just describe the current status of those associations that I know well and look at how they're progressing, and specifically look at APIC, CHICA from Canada, SHE, the Australian Infection Control Association, or ACA, and then the Asia Pacific Society of Infection Control, and I'll explain a little more about APSIC to you especially, and then look at the work of the International Federation of Infection Control, or IFIC, and they were just the names that I was most familiar with. So I apologise for having left out any others, and I hope that that's not caused any offence. So I'd also like to evaluate the extent to which existing association activities generally meet the needs of their members, and how these associations are continuing to positively contribute to a very rapid and hopefully sustainable global progress that we're making in terms of the infection prevention profession. And then I'll wrap up this morning's presentation by proposing a model and thinking about some of the ways that we need to go forward very carefully as we collaborate as our organisations collaborate and how we can better work with leading international public health agencies, because they're important players in this game as well, and particularly around things like publication of guidance documents and directives. So quite a task, and let's have a look now at the next slide, which is the arrow of coloured. The colourful history of how these organisations were developed. And I put this out for the first time and put it all together and was struck by a few things. First of all, it's been a long time since the first association that I'm dealing with was developed, and that was the APIC organisation forming in 1972. And I won't tell you how old I was then, but nobody would have ever taken me seriously at that point, and some still have trouble. But just to put it into a global context for you, in 1972, all that time ago, was when we were, actually it was the year that the Goodyear blimp first flew, and it was also the year that the video game craze was introduced. So I don't know that both of those things are still going as strongly as APIC is, but it's been a long time. It's been, you know, 36, 37 years, and I think a remarkable achievement. But then what was interesting for me looking at this, and not really as an epidemiologist, but as someone with an interest in history, was seeing that there was a bit of a regular pattern here for about, you know, every 4 years there was another association popping up, and major associations. So CHICA very closely following APIC, and then SHE developing, and then ACA, our own Australian group, coming, pulling themselves together and formalising their arrangement, and then just a few years later, the International Federation. But it was some 10 or so years later that my friends and peers in Asia decided to move together in a regionalised model, which is different to each of those other national models and probably more like a diluted IFIC. So it's, the key point, I guess, is that it's been a long time since we've been formalised initially, and we've had that sustained growth, and I wonder if we will ever reach the point where all countries have associations. So then when I looked onto the next slide, please, when I looked more closely at what each of these organisations aimed to do in the beginning, there's some current, there's some good themes that run through this analysis as well. And first of all, we see that when APIC formed, they wanted to develop an organised and systematic approach to the control of infections. So I think those words systematic and organised are very telling and speak loudly to the real early aims of all of these associations, really. Interesting to note there the use of the word control of infections, whereas I now know that, you know, almost four decades later, our more popular words are not around control, but rather around elimination, or dare I say, the word zero. So we looked then again at CHICA, and it had, you know, some additional information in it. It was a multidisciplinary group, and so probably a little bit different to APIC, which was originally and still has largely a nursing basis. CHICA had embraced this concept of multidisciplinary membership and was developed for the professional organisation of those people who were working to also control infections. And then when SHE established themselves, their mission again was different to those of the other two organisations, and they focused, and I believe still continue to focus, on advancing the application of science of healthcare epidemiology, and they do a great job in advancing that science. And so I think that these organisations were each starting to cleave out an individual role for themselves and for their members, and each were coming to market with a different point of differentiation, so to speak. And then way over here on the other side of the world, we were, although we had infection control practitioners from 1962, which I think makes us one of the early countries, and often that's an unknown fact, so I put it out there quite proudly. It then took us a long time, comparatively, to galvanise nationally in Australia and form our Australian group, and the major work that we do there and have continued to do is both to support our members and to encourage their collaboration And despite what I know, you all know about Australians being fun-loving and friendly group of people, one of the worst things about us is that we tend to be very marginalised at a state level. And so we don't get the level of participation and agreement between our states. And so therefore collaboration was something that's incredibly important for us professionally in infection control, and we still struggle in some regards into getting that true national sense of collaboration. And then in 1987 we had IFIC, who formed as, again as a multidisciplinary organisation, but were really took on an incredibly important role as the overarching umbrella organisation for all of the those organisations that decided they wanted to join. And IFIC really became the patchwork quilt of infection prevention, and have again been colourful and very active, and have done some amazing work in the 20 or so years in which they've existed. And then most recently, the big organisations, and it's been amazing to be part of the APSIC group. I was fortunate to be one of the founding members of APSIC in 1998, and what we realised then was just the need for a regional organisation, and the primary things that APSIC wanted to do were to host biannual meetings. Now, the group, because of much of the world's population living in the Southeast Asian region, the group has gone from strength to strength, and it is not uncommon for this group to hold conferences where they have between 2,000 to 3,000 members, which is fairly remarkable when you think about them having only been around since 1998, and especially when they've got a somewhat informal membership structure. So these associations, their history, I think, really does demonstrate just the rapid growth and interest and explosion, really, in infection prevention all around the world. And importantly, if we look today at IFIC on their website, they report that they have 66 members, so that's from 55 countries, and I apologise to the 50 countries that I've not spoken about their associations, but a sobering fact, I think, in the IFIC membership is that whilst that's a really good number of countries, it's less than a third of the world's countries appear to have formal infection control associations. And so I would say to all of us that there's the challenge for the next 20 or 30 working years, if we have that many left individually, or it's the challenge perhaps for the next 50 years, is to get the remaining two-thirds of the world's countries involved in having their own infection professional association, other than, I guess, the Vatican, which is considered a country. So I don't think they'd have enough to pull together an association. So let's move on to the next slide. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about association life cycles, and some of you may be familiar with this line of thinking, but if I click onto the next slide, really, associations go through very well-defined life cycles like other organisations. And typically what happens in an association, not just a health association, but in any association, is that you have the first stage, which is the birth, and some of the characteristics there are that you have visionaries who found an organisation, and then at that point most of the workings of the association are performed by volunteers, and there are typically not paid staff. Not having that paid staff is problematic, I guess, for many organisations. But, you know, there are generally the basic operational systems in place, and these associations in that first stage of their life sometimes have the capacity to deliver very simple programs with educational content. And they would set themselves some simple strategic goals and a simple strategic plan, probably with about a 1 to 2 year time horizon. But the board is very much involved in managing the association and making decisions for it. And I think I'll be controversial, which is not uncommon for me, but I think probably very honest in saying that perhaps some of the organisations that I've mentioned already this morning are still at the first stage of their life cycle. And with apologies to my colleagues in Australia, I'll use the Australian group as an example. Despite our many years of existence, you could argue that we are in fact still at this first stage, and we're at an interesting point of having to make some serious decisions that will take us into the second stage. And if you move on to the next slide, I'll show you what that second stage or adolescence is like for an association. Typically, it's where you have expanded programs and a much broader outreach, so you're able probably to reach either different professional groups within your own country, or you're able to expand to people working in the primary field in places outside of your country borders, or you're able to bring in people who are core memberships outside of the borders, and in fact other different types of professionals as well. So it's just that whole broader outreach. And one of the distinguishing points of the second stage of the life cycle is the addition of paid staff. And the board assuming a role much more as overseeing the organisation rather than having responsibility for the day-to-day function. And like human life, I think the transition from birth and the early years into adolescence can be an incredibly turbulent time. And for those of you that may have been involved in organisations that have made the transition across these two life cycles, you would probably attest to some of that turbulence. And it's an interesting place to be. Now, if you move on, please, to the next slide, you'll note that there's in red this whole issue of stagnation and decline. And this is the problem that associations can find themselves in if they don't progress beyond the point of adolescence into true growth and adulthood. What happens is there's a risk for the organisation, like any organisation, there's a risk for the association to actually decline. And some of the signs of decline, or some of the things that we may see, are that there are increasing bureaucratic ways of doing business within the association. There's much more of an internal focus rather than looking externally for inspiration and, I guess, for other opportunity. There can also be some periods of complacency within the organisation and missed opportunities for growth, a lack of the association being both flexible and adaptable, and then sometimes a failure to innovate. And those things can be very concerning, and I'm not in any way suggesting that those associations that I'm talking about today are stagnating or declining, but I just offer it as a well-researched piece of information about a typical association's life. And maybe they're things that we always need to measure our associations against, or those of us that are in the leadership positions as well. And for those of you that are aspiring to be leaders in associations, then it's just a handy piece of information. So on to the next slide, and it's a more optimistic slide, which always is much more appealing to me. We think about these rates that we pass through the life cycle as being fairly measured, but in fact they probably could be a little bit more subtle. And importantly, just as people go through different stages of life at a different rate, so too do organisations. And so some organisations will rapidly speed through these rates and reach this full-blown maturity, whereas others will be much more slower to make that passage. And those passages can be both difficult and they can be destabilising for the association and or for their memberships as well, and sometimes even for those who are in paid positions within the organisation. So I guess associations really are very vibrant and living entities like many of the others. But when an association reaches maturity, what we find is that they have staff that are actually specialised and able to focus on specific goals of the group. The leadership for the association is much more of a shared leadership model. So we have, for example, boards that are able to be involved in the governance and can think about the strategic and governmental decisions that need to be made without actually having to be the ones responsible for operationalising those decisions. And what would typically happen is that we would start to see some diversity on the board, and that diversity, I know the APIC example very well, that diversity, I think, in APIC is through the involvement of international members on the board and also through the involvement of our the non-traditional infection control members, and that's a terrible thing that just reflects the earliness of the morning, and I apologise for that. So the board and the associations also tend to look externally and focus more on the opportunities that exist, as well as obviously continuing to meet their membership needs. But the associations that have reached this level of maturity start to become very innovative, and they're becoming increasingly able to adapt to changes in the field and the profession, and in fact changes in the drivers that drive their members and typically impact the work of their members. So what can also happen, making this a little tricky as associations move through these stages of life, is that the strategies that have been employed in the early stages or in previous stages may no longer be appropriate as the association moves through, and so there can be some growing pains, literally, as they may move through. And the things that are very important to make these transitions and for associations to continue to be stable is that they undergo a very thoughtful assessment and are careful about their strategic planning and continue to develop their leadership, because those are key elements that will help the transition. So then when we look at the organisational growth curve, if we look at the next slide, please, I want to look at how APIC has made the transition to the point of being an integrative or a level 3 organisation. And we think about, you know, where APIC was to where it is today, and probably the need, in APIC's case, they've started yet another growth curve and so are in some formative or normative stages of the second wave of APIC's growth. And this could happen in other organisations as well. I don't know the CHICA model as well at such an intimate level, and so nor the IFIC model, and so I won't use them as examples. But going through this growth, Cathy Warray, APIC CEO, makes the point often that it's very much like a start-up business, and that there are always issues and challenges that you would see equivalent to a start-up business. We'll look, please, at the next slide and see how the profession, our infection prevention profession, has actually grown. And we look back at the formative years, and the things in there that we start to see in this model are the outbreaks of staph and all of those things that we know led to our formation. And then we had, as we moved into the normative stage, we were able to establish the profession. We started doing things like benchmarking a lot through the work of our colleagues at CDC and then in the NIST. And then we were able to respond to other mandates. And I think in the normative stage, APIC members started to realise that zero was a possibility, somewhat distant at that stage, but it was a possibility. But at the same time, we found ourselves, and this is around the early 2000s, we found ourselves at risk of stagnation. And we were hearing from members about the problems they had within their organisations, about lack of support, just reaching a benchmark figure for their infection rates and risking the chance to stay there, but not really being willing to go that little extra bit further towards zero, and really at some level them being unable to adapt or change their capacity. And so APIC were very, I think, thoughtful and tried to integrate where the members were with how the profession was growing and the global drivers. And so they have helped move their members into, and the association itself, into this third stage, or the integrative stage, where we have really embraced things like the culture of zero tolerance and zero infections, the involvement of multidisciplinaries and multidisciplinary colleagues, and integrating their involvement across systems and adding value for patients, emphasising the use of evidence-based approaches, and then, you know, helping our members realise that infection prevention is actually owned by everyone. So it's been a rapid but a really, I think, a rewarding growth. And for those of you that have been APIC members for a long time, I know that you will share you'll share the pleasure, I hope, of where the organisation's gone. And I know, too, that Chica have made similar growth steps. So, you know, kudos to Chica as well and to IFIC continuing to grow. And I think ACA and APSIC, the other two organisations, are probably a little further back on the growth curve. But through the work of the other three groups, we know, you know, things that need to be done and how to do that. So let's move on now to slide number 14, which is just a quick summary, and I don't need to go through all of these examples, but I guess I just wanted to show you that, you know, as a very mature organisation, that, you know, APIC is very clearly focused on at least these six different areas. They're specialised in, around public policy, around their educational opportunities that they offer to members and to others. They've got a fine research program that has done some great work around C. diff and last year MRSA, and again this year the second MRSA prevalence study. We've got some good work going on in public relations and communications, and then people like Sharon and others I know have been intimately involved in influencing and developing practice guidance. So very discrete areas of specialisation and, you know, a large membership, a lot of very productive and healthy relationships with other important agencies such as those that are involved in regulation and other things like that. So, you know, it's a good example, I think, of the maturation of the organisation and how APIC has gone through that whole organisational growth curve. So with that, I want to spend some time away from APIC and look a little more at Chica, and I know that each of you can access this information from the web as I did, and I would encourage each of you to become familiar with how these different organisations operate and in fact what they're able to offer. So we know that Chica are based in Canada, a very beautiful part of the world, and that they too are a national organisation with multidisciplinary voluntary membership. People grow and have been, I think Chica's probably had a very rapid growth proportional to their population if we compare it to America, or the United States rather. And what we know is that Chica, with over 1,000 members, 1,255 they promote on their website, that Chica are committed to improving the health of Canadians, and they do that by promoting excellence in the practice of infection prevention and control, and by using evidence-based approaches and also applying epidemiological principles. So all sounds incredibly sensible and strategically very smart, and Chica continue to meet that mission by their educational offerings, their communication activities, and then their involvement through developing standards and supporting research and consumer awareness. So they're right on the money for that, and I'm sure those of you that are Chica members are rightly very proud of being part of that organisation. And we'll move on to the next slide now and look a little bit at Shay. And it was actually interesting for me to realise that as I was pulling this presentation together, I'm actually a card-carrying member of three of these organisations of which I'm speaking today. And it was interesting, that fact that, you know, being someone foreign to North America, I, at some stage of my life, found it necessary to be part of at least three of these groups to really meet all of my infection prevention needs. And even if that was something that I did in desperation, perhaps in the early days, I've continued to be proud a member of each of these associations, and each one continues to offer me different things and to add value. And so I don't think that the world will ever be too small for different associations, and that as we specialise, there will always be something special and unique that people can give us as we practice in infection prevention. And probably the other observation is that the more global we become in our individual practices, then there's always the need to better understand countries, and you can do that well through their associations, not necessarily through or only through membership, but through being involved with their leaders and being aware of what goes on there. So Shay is a growing organisation. They are very active with their membership, and they're strengthening their membership. And looking at different sources for members, they're looking at different branches of medicine rather than just traditional infectious disease. Infectious diseases streams, they're also actively recruiting members from the public health arena and from healthcare epidemiology and patient safety. So SHAE, very much like CHICA and APIC and the others, have specific expertise that is sought often by regulatory agencies and accrediting organisations. They have a very much a focus on the science, and their scientific contributions, again like ACRE and CHICA, are sought in guiding decision-making bodies towards very rational, effective and cost-conscious policies, which are the types of policies that we on the ground truly appreciate. So SHAE's point of differentiation, I think, traditionally has always been their highly scientifically focused base, and I would suggest with respect that that comes from the large proportion of their members who are medical practitioners or physicians, as you may call them, in that part of the world. So let's move on to the next slide, and I'll proudly tell you a little bit about our Australian Infection Control Group, who have been around, I told you, for more than 20 years. ACRE, our group, is actually an unfortunate acronym for North America, I guess, but has little meaning down here other than we think of it as the Australian Infection Control Association. It is our peak national body. It has become much more active in representing the interests of our specialised practice of infection control in Australia, and the major difference that I feel and know is true in ACRE at the moment is they've got this reluctance to use the term infection prevention. So that's why I've respected that and refer to infection control when I'm talking about their activities. But it's interesting that unlike the rest of other parts of the world, they want to hold on to the term infection control for now, and they're more happy with that. But ACRE continues to provide an important forum for Australians and a few other international folk who are practicing or even have a working interest in the specialised field of infection control. And it is a national body. It has a variety of stakeholders who are involved in its activities, and their primary mission is to develop strategies that will minimise the risk of healthcare-associated infections for all Australians. They've become very active in negotiations and shaping the future of Australian infection control through collaboration in the last 18 months with one of our august national quality bodies. And so ACRE is really at, I think, probably as an important transitional stage, and that truly, as I said before, has not been without pain, but it has also been with great reward and productivity. So all of you are more than welcome at any time to come visit or to meet and liaise with members of the Australian group, and I know that Claire Boardman, our president and executive, would welcome you at any time to our national meetings, which are held every second year. So please feel free to have a look at the ACRE website if it's of interest to you, and it'll help you understand a little bit more about us. So let's have a look at the 18th slide, the next one. And this is an interesting group. This is the Asia Pacific Society of Infection Control. And for many, many, many years, there was growth, minimal growth in infection control in Southeast Asia. And even with I think, great vision and foresight, it was around 1989 that we gathered together representatives from about 12 different Asian countries. We formed and developed the Asia Pacific Society of Infection Control. And that formation really was, in those days, we said the key thing to do would be just to have a regional meeting, to have a regional congress every second year. And in fact, APSIC has been able to do that, and each second year for the time since they formed, they've held a conference which, as I said, has continued to grow in both spirit. Attendance at the conference continues to rise, and also we're starting to see the emergence much more of science coming out of the Asian region. And it was quite, I think, prophetic that these members formed APSIC even before, several years before the SARS outbreak and then the other problems that they've had in the region with H1N1, and it really was an untapped jewel in the infection control world. And I think that certainly for me, many of the lessons that I've learned in infection control and infection prevention have come from Southeast Asia. It's been a great learning ground for me, and I've especially enjoyed seeing the APSIC group really shop around, and they look very carefully at what's happening in the other parts of the world, and then are able to modify and extrapolate approaches so that they better fit into their Asian needs. Now, one of the real challenges that APSIC faces is, in fact, that the needs across Southeast Asia are very diverse, and so even in their core member countries, you could have one group who are very mature in terms of infection prevention thinking and infrastructure, and two countries that come to mind immediately are Singapore and Hong Kong. They've got very formalised approaches nationally towards infection prevention, so they're quite mature. And then you have other countries that are much younger in terms of infection control prevention and much less well-resourced to tackle some of the problems that we come across on a day-to-day basis. And I think about countries like Bhutan and places like Myanmar or old Burma, Thailand even to some extent, and Vietnam. So there are challenges, but one, I think, a very telling comment about APSIC was one made by Professor Wing Hong Sito from Hong Kong, and this was a comment he made just last month at the meeting, and saying that it's important that we come together and share the new challenges that confront us as APSIC members, and that infection control can only be done with strong global and regional links. We must stay in touch with one another. And whilst that message was primarily for APSIC members, that message, I think, is equally relevant to any of us in any part of the world at the moment, that we do need to come together to continue to be together and to share the knowledge that we've developed, and that we have a much stronger impact if we are working together globally, and that we maintain these strong regional links. And so hopefully today, by better understanding a little about each organisation, you can see that they fit together very nicely, and that together hopefully we'll be able to bring in the remaining two-thirds of the world that appear not to have formal infection control programs and associations. Let's have a look at the next slide, which is just a very quick slide of the IFIC group. IFIC is such an important umbrella organisation. I cannot underpin the importance of having a group like this, and really it's able to fill in to meet some needs that have been otherwise missed, as we've had the more mature groups work around largely their national activities. And why IFIC is a special group, for lots of reasons, but a major reason that it's special is that it is the only worldwide networking opportunity available for individuals working in infection control, and also it's a networking opportunity for societies or professional associations that are actively involved in infection prevention and control to gather together and to share thoughts and strategies and different approaches. And how IFIC does that is by helping communication between individual members and communication between organisations, by providing tools which are suitable across the globe, and then other educational materials, as well as by helping individual organisations in their developmental process. So IFIC's has a distinct role in that they help develop other new organisations, and that help is something that I guess the pioneers, the APICs of the world and the CHICA, we had to, I think, sometimes fight our way down the developmental pathway, but hopefully organisations like IFIC are able to help and guide those younger organisations as they develop. There are future challenges that IFIC have identified and are trying to address. They believe that our understanding of the costs of healthcare-associated infections, and truly understanding what makes an infection prevention strategy effective, we need to know that a lot more. We need to know a lot more information about those things, and so they're keen to work around that and to perform research. They're hoping that they can have support from industry and foundations through grants to conduct several research projects that will help clarify those issues, and also IFIC is actively seeking to increase its membership, which will bring it about its sustainability. And also they're looking at broadening both the magnitude and the scope of their work, and that's consistent with the transition to the move from early growth stages of organisations. So we can see that IFIC is on the move, and I wish all of the IFIC members good luck with that. And I know each of us through our own organisational memberships are members of IFIC anyway, so I know that there's plenty of opportunity for those of us to contribute and to respond to IFIC's calls for help from time to time as well. So let's move on to the next slide, where I spend some time now just reflecting on what's special about professional associations. And there's actually quite a big body of science, of bodies of knowledge about how professional associations work and how they function. And those of you that are involved in leadership positions within organisations, I draw your attention to this great reference from the Association of the American Society of Association Executives, based in Washington, have a lot of resources for associations generally, and have published a great book that titled The Seven Measures of Success, and they talk a lot in that book about what makes associations special and how what measures we can use to see if associations are successful. So really, I think, you know, key special things about associations different to other groupings are that associations are very often dependent on volunteers and the efforts of their volunteers. And that dependency on volunteers really lasts throughout the entire life of the organisation or the association, regardless of what stage they're at. And truly and honestly, without voluntary efforts, our associations, each one of them, would be having difficulties sustaining both their growth and even, in fact, their basic activities. So our volunteers are the lifeblood, as are our members, and, you know, we couldn't do anything without them. And so it's a wonderful testimony, I think, to our profession globally that we do have still such high levels of volunteerism. But like every other organisation that relies on volunteerism, it's getting increasingly difficult for people to volunteer, and I think that will be a huge challenge for all of our infection prevention associations over the next 10 to 20 years about how we maintain and invigorate our volunteers and support them and make sure that they don't burn out and that, you know, they don't overwork and that we have the next generation coming through and that they're aware of what it requires to be a volunteer. Another important and special point about professional associations are that they can go largely unnoticed, and so to that end it's important that they are active in their promotion and their lobbying and getting a seat at the table. But associations are important, they hold structures together, and as such they have to work for greatness, and that's definitely been my observation as we look at infection control and prevention and the developments we've made in 40 years and how it's become safer for patients to consume healthcare with lower infection risk over 40 years. A lot of that must be, I think, attributed to the work of professional associations in driving campaigns and designing campaigns and supporting educational initiatives and providing forums for exchanging information and all the other things that professional associations do so well. In the AP, on the next slide, if we look at the APIC Strategic Plan 2012, their vision statement, Leading the Way, they make an important comment on effectiveness and relevance, and that comment is that for a professional association to remain effective and relevant, it must find that important balance between addressing the immediate concerns of its membership and also charting the path for the profession's future growth and success. And that, I think, is just such an overwhelming challenge. As associations grow and organisations grow, we need to continue to be relevant to our members because they are our lifeblood and they're the reason that we exist. But in maintaining that relevancy and maintaining effectiveness, we also need to make sure that we're able to grow the association and continue to develop it. So that's the real challenge. Thankfully, at APIC we have our paid staff and our incredibly hardworking CEO and others that help make that task a whole lot easier for us. But if we go on, please, to the next slide titled The Seven Measures of Success, you'll see these seven qualities that associations that are successful each will demonstrate, and they are as listed there, but obviously the culture of customer service is important, making sure that everything an association offers aligns with the mission of the organisation and the association, that any of the strategic activities that are performed are underpinned by data and measured, and their impact considered and evaluated, that by being successful we need to continue to have open, frank, fearless dialogue, and we need to be engaged with decision makers, we need to be engaged with our members, we need to be engaged with people outside of the association who are impacting the fields in which we operate. And then in other successful organisations, the CEO, where they exist, are actually the brokers of ideas. And so they've got a very specific role which is different to the role of the president or the elected board members, but the CEO becoming the broker of ideas, and that's one I think that's been difficult. It's in some places can be very difficult for organisations to appreciate the critical role that the CEO plays. Organisations that are adaptable are also ones that are successful and are able to build alliances with other like associations and other stakeholders. So they're what we think are the seven measures of success. We use these to look at our performance at APIC. One of the measures we use to look at performance and our achievements, and hopefully they may give some insights to those of you who may be wanting to review where your own association is at. It's interesting, we've got a number of challenges at the moment. The global economic downturn is just a challenge for all of us in life. It's impacting healthcare institutions and then reverberating and impacting our revenue sources for organisations, and you see that through difficulty with attendance at educational meetings, and probably you may be seeing it through just maybe even changes in your membership or in membership purchases. The other challenge that's an important one is that we're increasingly operating in a very crowded marketplace. A phrase used last year when we were doing some work around the APIC branding. And what we've got is some competition going on for the niche, the traditional niches that we've held. And that competition can be from other associations, from our brother and sister associations, but I think that there's room for all of us to operate well and nicely in this marketplace, and there are different individual things that each of us bring to the members or potential members all around the world. One of the other challenges we've got is that we've got the emergence of people who, I'll call them the unproven players, but just as a point of differentiation, not really reflecting the quality of what they offer, but we've got new players to the field who are influencing the field and influencing our profession, and they're people like the consumer groups, media, people speaking in the media. We've got other quality groups that are involved, institutes, groups that are involved in accreditation, other people that have had different roles in the past and are now moving into those roles that have been more typically associated with associations, so they're moving into not their traditional work but moving into things like areas like education and providing resources. So it's good, it's healthy to have additional people bringing additional perspectives to the table. So the other challenge that we have amidst all of these other driving forces or external factors, I guess, are that we need to keep up the pace of going forward at our association levels. We need to be very focused in what we're trying to achieve strategically, and we need to maintain our direction. So let's move on again to the next slide. Some more challenges. Everything's a challenge. We're working all over the world with increasing regulation and increasing legislation, which can be quite compelling and distracting as well. We've got the challenge of advancing our whole profession of infection prevention and then making sure that we are able to negotiate those coveted seats at the important tables, and by that phrase I'm thinking about the importance in APIC's work, especially of being involved with lobbying efforts and being able to influence regulation and the activities that happen at Capitol Hill. We're seeing the same sort of negotiation needed here in Australia, where our ACA members are needing to sit at the table with the Australian federal government as they develop quality initiatives. And I'm sure that Canada, the CHECA members would be also seeking their place at the important table in Canada. And I know that IFIC is seeking its place with other organisations like the World Health Organisation and other leading public health agencies, the Centers for Disease Control as well. A very different challenge, but a very real challenge, is trying to fill that pipeline, trying to attract new blood to our profession and making our association and the work that we do in infection prevention attractive to new folk. Many of you are aging in infection control. I'm struggling to continue my youthfulness, but the reality is many of us are getting towards the at least the second half of our working lives, and there's not, unfortunately, I can't see a cadre of younger, newer people belting down the doors to join our profession, and I don't understand why that is, because to me it's the best profession in the world and the best part of healthcare to be involved in. However, I think it really demonstrates to us the need to promote and promote our profession and our associations, and to attract new blood and new ideas and new ways of thinking. One of the other challenges that we face, again, separate to any of the others I've spoken about, is the ongoing concept and the notion that good education should be free. And so we have wonderful initiatives, in fact, like this Weber teleclass series that are able to provide it often for free, and then there becomes an expectation that other pieces of education should equally be free and they can't be produced. So that's just a challenge we go forward. And then there's always that ongoing challenge of the demands of the community outstripping the capacity of an organisation to develop, and I guess it requires that focus and clarity and strategy that we've talked about. So let's move on then to the next slide and spend some time looking at the extent to which existing associations actually meet their member needs. Well, I think that there's really a series of questions rather than answers around this, and the questions I'd encourage each of the associations to ask themselves is, how do you assess the needs of your members and how effective is that assessment? And as each of us experience an increasing diversity of membership, is it real for us or realistic for us to even aim to meet individual needs of members, or rather can we just meet their needs generically? And then the other question is, do we need to focus collectively at local issues, focus and have more work through the chapter sorts of models, or do we think more broadly on the national and even the international needs of members? And then should we allocate specific tasks to specific associations according to the profiles and of their members and their expertise? For example, should one group, as we go around the world, should one group become better just at influencing clinical practice, whereas others may have better expertise at guiding policy and regulation, or some others may have better grasp of research? And so I wonder whether then replicating efforts, whether we shouldn't be specialising. And again, I throw that out there just as a wild thought. So let's have a look on the next slide about how associations can contribute positively in the final part of my presentation this morning or this afternoon, wherever you guys are. We'll click on to the next slide. And I think here are some of my thoughts and those of some others that I've spoken with about how associations can contribute positively to the worldwide progress of infection prevention. Well, however we look at it, and despite the internationalisation of infection control, obviously, serving members within the core company, the core country of the association, has to come first. And if we fail to do that, then we will not have a satisfied membership, and I think we would lose a lot of effort. So, as much as I love the internationalisation of infection control, each of you, I would continue to encourage you to support first the members in your core country. and your core region. And similarly, I would suggest that you stick to the core services that you know you do well. We probably may need to, in sticking to those core services, we also need to probably review and recycle, refresh, refine and repurpose some of the work that we've done rather than, I think, reinvent the work that gets done. And one of the most frustrating things is to see associations reinvent work that other associations have done well and just spend a whole lot of time reinventing when, in fact, you could be coming up with some new strategies or new ways of doing business. So being open to those new opportunities and new models is another way that globally we can help support progress. So let's have a look at the next slide, please. It's important, I think, that as we think about this, that whilst we can have some overarching high idealistic goals in establishing minimum standards in infection control and prevention, we need to really always keep in mind that there are several countries that really are at that early developmental stage of infection prevention specifically, and that they're either developing or transitioning. And in those countries, it's never, well, not never, but it's not possible now for them to reach the level that some of the other more developed countries have reached. And they're, for all of those reasons, overcrowding, the inadequate hygiene, poor management, infrastructure, insufficient technology. And it's incredibly frustrating when you're working in those countries. I hear this and see this frequently when they believe that they should be struggling to move on to more developed levels, like looking at things like certification for their ICPs, yet in fact when you look at their clinical settings, they don't even have adequate systems for running water. And so I think we as individuals with an opportunity to influence development always need to be sensitive to these very basic fundamental things that need to be in place before you can probably even have strong supporting professional infrastructures. Next slide, just an example of what the reality is in resource-poor countries, outdated technologies, a lot of emerging infections, unfortunately, and some very simple innovations, which optimistically, I have to tell you, some of the simple innovations are actually the most clever. Time doesn't permit me talking about those, but please at any time if you ever want to chat about some of the great innovations that I've seen, and I know others of you have seen as well. There's a lot we can learn from simplicity too. Let's have a look at the next slide. The reality in the developed countries is absolutely diametrically opposed to that in the developing countries, and in that I mean, you know, we're highly regulated. Our consumers are starting to take a voice. We're looking at reducing costs and other technologies and things like that. So on the next slide, let's think about a future model. Are we actually close to a future model, or are we there yet? On the next slide, I think that there is one model that to me has demonstrated the ability to extrapolate good infection prevention around the world, and it has to be the World Health Organization's hand hygiene campaign. And it has, in my observations, it has revolutionized infection prevention approaches dramatically and very successfully. I know that WHO do a good job of describing and detailing the impact of that program on their website, and I would encourage you to become familiar with that. It gives me great hope to think that we can have at least one or two or maybe more things that we can do in infection control well all around the world. Next slide, lots of room for improvement and activity as we go, opportunity as we go forward, understanding that for members in different parts of the world, if they get conflicting guidance, that can cause them a lot of pain. It can even be dangerous for them and confusing. And the classic example is, of course, respirators versus surgical masks, and people struggling in developing countries to understand what they really need. Will they be less safe, or will they be in danger if they only have surgical masks? We also need to understand what would constitute the global minimum standard for infection prevention. We also need to be working at and helping our members around the world develop political goodwill and understanding that both political goodwill and robust economies are critical to any large-scale improvement. And then also understanding that cultural norms will always impact how associations function. and what they can reasonably deliver, and they may be constrained by some of those cultural norms. Next slide, the equation for association success. We can't write it up because there are so many multiple factors. Just know that what works well for one association may not lead to success for another. On the next slide, I think we've got a great model. It has IFIC centralised at that model. It has developed countries with their associations, transitional countries and developing countries on the edge, and each of the groups that we've talked about today. And then we have the interplay of the two leading public health organisations, the World Health Organisation and the Centres for Disease Control and Prevention, their global activities branch. So the final slides, we can work towards global harmonisation and infection prevention with true consensus statements globally, stepwise development and modifications for practice, using common language, being empathetic at all times and sharing accountability for making healthcare safer globally. On the next slide, I'll conclude, and I apologise for going over my time, just by sharing with you that, you know, healthcare-associated infections occur frequently. They cost a lot of money. They're substantial in human cost as well. There are a gazillion opportunities locally and globally to reduce healthcare-associated infections, rather, and that professional associations are and rightly should remain the most appropriate vehicles that we have for defining, developing and building the capacity of the infection prevention profession all around the world. So I thank you for making it this far with me. My final slide are my contact details, and please feel free to connect with me in person anywhere that you see me or by email. I've really enjoyed the opportunity, and again I thank Paul and Sharon for this chance and for those of you taking the time out to listen. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Kath. I personally got a lot out of this, and I felt like I was an old hand at a lot of this, and it has been tremendous information. Just as a reminder, there will be additional teleclasses coming up in the free teleclass series of summer, but you can always go back to the Weber Training website to be able to review Kath's slides again and ask her questions, because we now have her email address. And as she suggested, you will see her at all the different conferences. And speaking from personal experience, she is a great resource and always happy to answer questions. For those that didn't hear at the beginning, it's only 4:30 in the morning on Friday now in Australia. So thank you so much, Bye. Kath and Paul and everybody for joining us today.
Bye now. Thanks, Sharon.
Bye-bye.